Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. Before I introduce my guest, economist John Williams this morning, let me just pass on some information. Listeners who tuned in on Friday know I had Jane Burgermeister on. She's an Austrian-based investigative journalist, and we discussed the swine flu situation, the possibility of mandatory vaccinations, the criminal charges she's filed. You can access the program through archives and listen to it. But I got an alert this morning from Jane. She said, possibly as we're speaking right now at this moment, the WHO, the World Health Organization in Geneva, is recommending to all countries in the world, 194 countries that are signed on to WHO, to vaccinate their entire populations with an experimental, dangerous, untested swine flu vaccine. Nobody in their right mind should take this vaccine if you value your health. Now, the only question in my mind is whether WHO is going to mandate it. And, of course, people where I live in the U.S., whether the U.S. government will mandate it also. Well, we've had two programs on this. We'll have more. It's crucially important to stay away from this stuff. It's toxic. It's dangerous. It destroys your immune system. So if you value your immune system, stay away from these vaccines, but watch out for the swine flu hype machine to gear up again, either later this month, without question in August, getting ready for the fall flu season. We'll certainly cover more details on this as they break ahead in future programs. But my guest today is John Williams. John is a consulting economist. He's the editor of Shadow Government Statistics. It's a website. It's an electronic newsletter. Individuals, listeners can subscribe to it. And John calls government data, rightfully, manipulated, corrupted, unreliable. So he reverse engineers it to get a more accurate assessment of what's going on in the economy. So we want to talk about the state of the economic crisis, some of the numbers that John puts out to his subscribers, a little bit on his website, to give people an idea of what the real economic situation is. It's not pretty. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Oh, John, it's great having you back. let's cover all of the stats that you think are so important. Oh, the one that absolutely jumps off the page at me is unemployment. You want to tell listeners what the unemployment rate really is, and not the fiction that the Labor Department puts out?
Well, it depends how you define it. And if you look at it, I think the way most people would look at it, if you ask someone if he or she's unemployed, you don't have to wait too long for a response. A person doesn't have to think about it. They can tell you whether or not they're unemployed. if you look at it from that standpoint, I think you'd find that the unemployment rate would be up a little over 20%, around 20.6 or such as of latest counting. And that's more than double the popularly followed unemployment rate, which I think is currently around 9.4 or 5. Problem is the government puts out different measures of unemployment. It knows that the questions that it asks and the headline unemployment rate don't necessarily cover people who really are unemployed, but for various reasons are sort of jetted off to minor statistics. The government.
Let me break in. That music means a commercial break. Let's take that, sure. And we'll come right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with economist John Williams. John, again, we're talking about the differences between the larger and the smaller number, and the Labor Department has this so-called U3 headline number, and they also have the one you never hear about on the major business channels, the so-called U6 number. And then, of course, we've got your calculation. Maybe explain that to listeners.
Sure. The government actually publishes six levels of unemployment each month. And the as you're suggesting, with the U3 is the third level. That's the popularly followed number, the one that the press headlines each month. That was 9.5% in June. U6, which is the broadest measure published by the government, includes what they call discouraged workers and marginally attached workers. The marginally attached would include people who, such as I'm out here in California, the state has mandated three furlough days a month where people have to take the time off without pay. So they're being forced to work part-time for economic reasons. But the most important number really is a discouraged worker. And a discouraged worker is defined by the government as someone who's basically all the qualifications of being unemployed. They don't have a job. They want to work. They're able to work. But they've given up looking for work because there are no jobs to be had. And the way the government currently defines that, they can only have been discouraged for less than a year. In other words, they have to look for work in the last 12 months. And on that basis, the unemployment rate 16.5%, as reported by the federal government for the month of June. Back in 1994, before 1994, the discouraged workers measure was much broader. There was no time limitation on how long people had been discouraged. So anyone who'd been discouraged for more than a year was counted, and when they changed the definition to only those who'd been discouraged for less than a year, it knocked several million people off the rolls of those being counted for the broader measures. And I estimate that and add it back into the U6 measure, and on that basis I'm looking at something at around 20.6%. And you tell people that unemployment's around 20.6%, I think that's pretty close to what you'd get if you went around the country and just asked people the simple question whether or not they were unemployed. So whether or not they considered themselves unemployed, meaning basically that they didn't have work, but they wanted to work and were ready and able to work.
John, can I throw a question at you? Back in the 1930s, when unemployment peaked to 25%, and of course the composition of the working force was much different than agriculture was a much bigger factor. And I guess this was non-farm unemployment, 25%.
Actually, 25% is the estimate of total unemployment. And that was for the year 1933, which is considered the worst of the Great Depression.
Was it a pretty clean calculation in those days, without the distortions you have to correct for in producing your data?
What you have to keep in mind is that the government did not survey unemployment back in the Great Depression, so that that estimate of 25% was an estimate. It's a guesstimate constructed after the Great Depression. They didn't start surveying unemployment until the 1940s. So it was put together from a number of measures. It's not a particularly accurate number, and it probably had some politics in it as well, but that 25% is sort of the standard that's accepted, but as you noted, that included a very significant portion of the population that worked on farms. About 27% of the population worked on farms. Today, that's less than 2%. And they did publish, the Social Security Administration put out an estimate of non-farm unemployment. The non-farm unemployment rate in the Great Depression hitting a peak of roughly 35% in 1933. And if I were to come up with a comparable number for today's environment, I would take my number at 20.6%, and I'd put that against the non-farm number of 35%. I think that would be a little more reflective of common circumstance. In terms of what I'm looking at right now, it's hard to estimate numbers before 1994 because all the definitions were changed at that time. They changed a lot of things beyond redefining discouraged workers. But as best I can figure it, that what we're seeing right now in terms of the unemployment rate, it's basically where it was at the trough of the 1973-1975 recession, which was the worst since the Great Depression. We're seeing a number of measures that indicate that what we're seeing right now is really the worst since the Great Depression. Probably will be called a depression, and I think eventually will evolve into a Great Depression, as we may get into a little bit. Let me just define a couple of things up front.
Let me say one thing, John. I think you're the only economist who has come up with a definition of a recession, a depression, and a Great Depression. Others talk about it in general terms.
It's something you probably should define if you're going to be talking about
indeed
it.
Indeed so. But you put numbers on it.
It is something that, I mean, the definitions that exist go back some in time, but it's not, again, sort of common experience. You talk to someone today and say, what's a depression? And say, oh, it's a very bad recession. That's really not what it means, although that's now sort of the common acceptance. Back before World War II, all economic downturns were referred to as depressions. And if you plotted the level of business activity on a graph, you'd see that activity dip and then come back up again, and that dip was referred to as a depression. The down leg of the dip was referred to as a recession, and the up leg of the recovery. After World War II, using the term depression for downturn was avoided because it evoked memories of the Great Depression. Nobody really wanted to get into that, so they just renamed the downturns and tended to call them recessions, that being the down leg of the depression. Decade or two back, I tried to get some hard definition on what the people involved with the numbers would consider to be a depression in today's commonly accepted concept of, you know, depression's a real bad recession. And I'm talking with people at the Bureau of Economic Analysis in Washington. They're the people who report the gross domestic product, the broadest measure of economic activity, the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is the defining authority in whether the U.S. economy is in recession. I came to sort of a consensus, but this is not official. It's not official for many of those entities. But generally, what I found was that people who worked with the numbers would consider a peak-to-trough contraction in the economy, adjusted for inflation, of greater than 10% as being a depression, and a peak-to-trough contraction of greater than 25% being a Great Depression. We have not had a depression or a Great Depression since before World War II. With a little bit of a caveat there. When production was cut down, was cut back after World War II, the war production was shut down. As you shifted back to a peacetime economy, of course, there was a large shift in production that, if it was counted as a normal economic cycle, would have shown as a depression. But that's generally not viewed as an economic cycle.
You're talking about late 1945, early 1946?
Yeah, and in fact, that's what we're seeing now. Keep in mind that most of the economic series were not reported before World War II because they didn't exist. Most of them were created post-war, or at least post-Great Depression. The only thing that goes back that far is industrial production. Most people just looked at the stock market as an indicator. But what we're seeing
one comment about after World War II, John, I guess the powers that be in the country were very worried about what would happen economically as war production ended and we had to switch over to civilian. Of course, there was one big advantage back then. People couldn't buy a heck of a lot during the war because production was so geared to producing weapons and so on.
Yep.
So there was an awful lot of stored up purchasing power, plus the GI Bill, plus all the housing that began to be built. So I guess that unleashed the prosperity that followed World War II.
It did. They had all the returning soldiers who, a lot of them got married, started their families, bought houses, started their own businesses, or went to work for people. It was a major turnaround, but it resulted in a period of generally sustainable economic growth, although it still had its ups and downs into the 60s when we began to run into some fiscal problems with the federal government. But again, that's something to be touched upon a little bit later. But right now, what we're looking at is
that music again, John.
I'll tell you why later.
We'll take another break and then we'll come right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with economist John Williams. John, I guess your longer range outlook is a pretty dark one, and you are looking at the possibility of a depression down the road. You also see potential hyperinflation at some point. I guess deflation is more in the spotlight right now, but the way the Fed has debased the dollar, my goodness, I don't know how much of this stuff you can print before it. Well, on Global Research, there's one contributor. He hasn't had an article there for a while, but he refers to the dollar in a couple of his articles as toilet paper. It's pretty dramatic. I call it confetti.
That's my definition of hyperinflation, when the largest denomination note before the inflation in the U.S. would be a $100 bill. Becomes worth more as toilet paper than as functional currency. You have hyperinflation in it. We are heading for that. But we are already in a depression, as I would define it, that being a 10% or more peak-to-trough contraction in economic activity. You're seeing that in a number of the numbers. You don't have it in the GDP yet, although I think even with the GDP, you're going to you see that, the gross domestic product.
What have you got GDP at right now?
Well, in terms of year-to-year change?
Latest quarter.
The latest quarter, you're down somewhat shy of 6% at an annualized rate, 5 or something like that. I'm working from memory here.
And year-over-year?
Not too meaningful.
Year-over-year is more important.
Year-over-year is down about, it's down about 2%. Maybe it's not there yet. I'll give you a hard number because I work on that as well. Yeah, you're down a little over 2%.
But what you're saying is GDP does not reflect how bad things really are.
Oh no, it's very much a politicized number. Perhaps the most heavily politicized. It's down 2.5%, and I figure it should be down about 5% in terms of current reporting year over year, which is halfway towards a depression level. But you have indicators, broad indicators, such as retail sales that are adjusted for inflation. They're down more than 10% peak to trough. Industrial production down more than 10% peak to trough. That's as it currently exists. You have the housing market that's down 75% peak to trough. New orders for durable goods are down more than 25% peak to trough. You have a couple of series there that are already in what would be considered Great Depression territory. I think even as the government publishes it, you'll see something here that will hit that depression threshold and be commonly talked about as depression. It's already being commonly touted as the worst downturn since the Great Depression. You look at the housing numbers, retail sales, you're seeing the weakest growth since right after World War II, which is when the series started. In terms of industrial production, you're seeing the steepest decline year over year since the shutdown of production at the end of World War II. So in many ways, we're already there. Going ahead, the federal government's bankrupt. That's been evident for a number of years, effectively bankrupt. I mean, hasn't declared bankruptcy, but if you look at financial statements that the U.S. Treasury publishes now, that are prepared using generally accepted accounting principles with accrual accounting and where they account for the unfunded liabilities in Social Security and Medicare. And then you look at the year-to-year change in that on what they call a net present value basis, where it's discounted for the future, future value of money. Effectively, what the amount of cash you need in hand today to cover the obligation, year-to-year change in that, you'd find that the federal deficit on that basis is running around $5 trillion per year.
As opposed to the projected headline number of one and a half.
Last year it was $454 billion or something like that. That was the official number. But the $5 trillion is also based on government reporting, just on from a different standpoint. I mean, the $5 trillion.
And there's no end in sight to this, John. I mean, we're talking about what's happening right now, and it looks like this is going to keep going a while.
Yeah, well, the $5 trillion is based on year-end 2008 with everything that's happened in the last year. I think you're going to be close to $9 trillion for the year 2009. But there's no way you can close a $9 trillion deficit by raising taxes. You could seize everyone's 100% of everyone's income and corporate profits, and you'd still be looking at a at a deficit. So it's beyond containment from that side, and I'll contend that on a political basis, there's no way the government can slash Social Security and Medicare to the levels needed to bring things under control. I mean, you'd have rioting in the streets, and the politicians in Washington would be thrown out, which probably is not too bad an idea.
It sounds like an excellent idea to me, John.
Yeah, but here they'd be thrown out for the wrong reasons.
My thought for all of them is an absolute clean sweep. Even some of the good ones have proposed legislation that is so outrageous that they have stripped away their mask and shown themselves to be what they really are, betrayers of the public trust. We have to take another break, John. Let's do it and come right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. On with economist John Williams. John, another economist who comes on the program now and then, Jack Rasmus. He is critical of what's going on like you are. He uses the term as to where we are right now. He says we're in an epic recession, but we're heading maybe dangerously fast to crossing over into the depression category. I'm not certain if he distinguishes between a depression and a Great Depression, but he's got a new article that he put out and he sent it to me, and he's very emphatic. He says not only has recovery not begun, but he, I don't want to list them all. He lists 18 reasons to be very, very worried. And he sees things like before the end of 2009, 22 million jobless. He says home equity values will continue to fall. He sees foreclosures rising up to maybe 10 million. Credit card spending in retreat. Pensions that are evaporating in front of our eyes. Capital spending, not much action there. Exports collapsed, and the state's in crisis, and on and on and on and on. And for anybody to talk about recovery, there is no recovery. I guess you'd agree on that.
Well, the risks he details are not unreasonable, and indeed, I'll contend we're not seeing any recovery or anything that would be considered a sustainable recovery. We have the worst of the economy ahead of us, and it is what you are seeing in some of the numbers, such as retail sales and the housing numbers, is that the year-to-year decline is sort of plateauing. If you were to plot it out, I mean, housing starts are down about 50% year over year. That's the sharpest decline ever seen, but you've been seeing that month after month now for four months or so. With retail sales, you're down about 10% after inflation adjustment year over year. Again, that sort of plateaued at that level. These are record low levels. And that isn't that the economy's bottoming out. It's just that you've been in such a steep decline for so long. We're going now on a year-over-year basis against periods of sharp decline last year. And what I think you'll see here, I mean, it's just the nature of an economic collapse that you don't drop to zero activity. There are points in time where you do a little bit of bottom bouncing, but you end up with what will be a multiple dip downturn, as we saw back in the early 80s. That was a double dip recession. I'll contend that what we're in right now is the second down leg of a very severe downturn that actually started back in 2001. That recession was longer and deeper than currently estimated. What we're in now also has been going on longer and is worse than is officially being reported. And what lies ahead is, a further decline. In terms of being in a depression, I think we already are, and it'll gain recognition in the next year. At such time as a hyperinflation kicks in, which is inevitable with the level of government obligations against government's ability to raise the money it needs to cover those obligations. When the hyperinflation kicks in the United States, and that could be within the next 5 years, there's some particularly high risk for this next year. But whenever it is, it'll tend to disrupt normal commerce, and enough so that I think that'll push us into the Great Depression level, down more than 25%. You look, for example, at Zimbabwe that has had an extreme hyperinflation. And if you took a pile of what used to be $2 bills, which was their smallest currency, and put a pile together that would equal what $2 Zimbabwe dollars is worth today, it would reach from the Earth to the Andromeda Galaxy. I mean, that's...
I'm not sure what that is.
That's how much, but it took them several years for that to unfold. It's not going to be quite like that here. There's a reason that you had the ability to draw it out over time. And still have the system function in Zimbabwe is that they had a black market in U.S. dollars, and a lot of economic activity just shifted to the black market. We don't have a black market in the United States to get around a weak dollar. Something like that may develop, but it certainly is not in place at this point in time to the system most likely breaking down into a barter system. It becomes a very unstable, unhappy time, time when people want to hopefully will have their wealth and assets preserved and be able to ride out a very difficult financial storm and what likely will be an upheaval in terms of politics and such. I can't tell you how it's going to go, but I can tell you that there will be enough economic pain to see a major shift in political parties, or beyond that. I can't tell you.
I think we need the birth of a brand new party.
There certainly will be the opportunity for that. But this is the type of circumstance that things can get so wild and woolly that almost anything can happen. And I'm not going to even speculate as to where that goes, other than you want to be as safe as you can in terms of your investing.
Well, there's no question about that. I think safety is critical. I absolutely feel that way. Young people can be a little bit more adventuresome. But us old folks, I've been around the track a few times myself. It's pretty scary to think that you could make a wrong move and whatever you manage to put away in a lifetime could just be swept away from you. It's like a big tidal wave that you get your back turned and you didn't really see it coming. You didn't anticipate it. But this stuff is happening. I fear greatly, John, that there could be just terrific pain that builds up over the months ahead. And that so many people will be hurt so badly, it could erupt into serious stuff on streets.
Yep.
That's
certainly the potential is there. But again, you know, I mean, that's just a common sense thing. If you look at it from a common sense standpoint, you can probably figure out what the risks are. There's so many different ways things could break here. I don't even want to speculate on it.
Oh yeah, it's impossible forecasting. I don't have to forecast. Thank heavens, and I love the line that about some of the professional economists who I don't know who said this, but I've heard it and I've mentioned it that some economists, maybe the ones who work for the big Wall Street firms, they forecast not because they know, but because they're asked. Well, it's their job to forecast. We need to speculate on what could be ahead. So what you do, John, you assess the economic situation and you can pick up on the trend and you can, and unless something happens that is not on the horizon now, I guess this trend will continue. And if it continues long enough, then it there's a pretty bad ending out there.
Well, we're in a cycle that had to come to an end. There were too many things that were unsustainable. The thing is that when one cycle ends, another begins, and the key is to be able to ride out the difficult times and be in a good position to take advantage of the opportunities that will eventually lie ahead.
Oh, they'll be there at some point, but who knows what treacherous waters that we have to get through, John, before we reach that point.
Yeah.
And I'm terrified about the absolute avalanche of lost jobs. I think in your latest report, the official number was about 460. I think you had 700,000 lost in June?
Yeah. Well, those numbers are... They're not that accurate to start with. Let me say that up front. A lot of surveying problems. Eventually, they revise the numbers. But there appear to be a couple of biases that are being utilized now that have the effect of reducing the level of the reported jobs losses out of the government's payroll survey. And... what you have to look at here is, from the standpoint of the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury and the politicians in Washington, they generally want to keep the news as good as possible to try and maintain as stable a circumstance as possible. Because to the extent that people are happier, have more confidence, they'll tend to spend more money. They'll tend to invest more money. But the areas where this confidence is being built up is not solid. I mean, the factors that are being used are either gimmicks or, you know, they're numbers taken out of context. The circumstance really hasn't improved. And as the numbers begin to fail again, as they will, even with a lot of massaging, you'll see an intensified collapse in consumer confidence, investor confidence, worse than you would have had the confidence been rebuilt based on solid numbers.
I think public statements like from Obama, of course, you can't expect a president to make a public announcement that everything is going to hell in a handbasket. So Obama comes on and he says the programs that he's instituted have had a big effect. They haven't, but he says they have. And the worst is behind us, and recovery is ahead. And, of course, again, he kind of come on and say we're collapsing as I speak to you right now. And I honestly don't know what to do about it.
That's the last thing a politician's going to tell you. I mean,
it would be a bad president if
he tells you that there's a problem. He won't tell you that unless he has an answer for it. Otherwise, he looks like an idiot. And the problem is there's no easy solution. In fact, I can think of no solution to avoiding a hyperinflationary Great Depression. And that's, you're not going to hear a lot of talk about that, accordingly, from the politicians.
What do you see the fate of the dollar, John? Do you think at some point something will replace it?
Well, it's in terms of the U.S., the dollar is going to become worthless. And against foreign currencies, it'll become relatively worthless as well. So an outcome of the hyperinflation would be a new dollar of some form. Probably have to have a new global currency system because the dollar is the world's reserve currency. And 80% of all currency transactions on a global basis have a U.S. dollar on one side of it. I can't tell you how that system's going to be restructured, but my betting would be that it will somehow involve a tie to gold, because the people who will be trying to sell this to the public are going to need something like that in order to sell the concept. The answer is yes, but I mean, whether it be just a new dollar or somebody tries to push a global currency, which I don't think is a good idea. In fact, I know it's a very bad idea. That remains to be seen. You certainly have had a lot of talk recently from some of our major trading partners how the dollar shouldn't be the world's reserve currency. There should be an alternative. And what you're getting there is really extraordinary because, again, these are sovereign statements from sovereign nations that normally are very circumspect in terms of what they say. When they tell you they don't want the dollar, you can be sure they don't. And talk about replacing the dollar is a suggestion of just how difficult it is to get people to buy the dollar or to buy U.S. treasuries, which is what we need to do because we're spending so much money. It does get funded by treasury borrowing. And as long as the treasury can raise such from the public, the global community, that's fine. But when it doesn't have enough buyers or the buyers are such that, really spike the demand so low that really spike interest rates.
John, there was a meeting of some consequence in mid-June in Yekaterinburg, Russia. You probably know that about what went on. Whether this was just feelers for what people are thinking about or whatever, but we're talking about countries, China, Russia, India, Brazil, the former stands, they were all there, expressing great concern about the dollar.
Yep.
And to some extent, at least, some of these countries, big ones, are trading with each other using their own currencies, not the dollar.
Yep.
Russia, China, Brazil.
That's where we're going to have a hyperinflation, because people will not buy the treasuries. They will not hold the dollars, and that leaves only one entity that will be there to support the system and to buy the treasury debt, and that's the Federal Reserve. And as they buy it, it monetizes the debt, increases the money supply. They've been trying to increase the money supply to avoid deflation. They haven't been able to get the broad money supply growth to really pick up yet, but they will as these various stimulus elements come forth and have to be funded, and that is monetized. Because as the Fed monetizes the what the Treasury's spending, those checks go out to people who deposit them in checking accounts. That goes right into the money supply. When they sell the debt to send out those checks, the public buys the debt. That comes out of the money supply and then goes right back into the money supply as the Treasury mails out the checks. But if it's the money is borrowed from the Fed, which just creates the dollars, then you have a big spike in the money supply and hyperinflation.
John, let's take another break, and we'll come back for a final segment. The hour does fly by fast. We will be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour, final segment with John Williams. John, I think this is a good time to let you kind of sum up the situation and what's ahead. And there's no question that this is a key topic on this program. And listeners are pretty darn concerned as to what's going to happen in their own lives. So I'll let you sock it to them as to what they should worry most about looking ahead.
Okay, well, the best advice I can give you is to go with your own instinct. I mean, if you don't believe the government's numbers, there's probably good reason behind that. I find the average person has a much better perception of what's going on than what you can get out of the government statistics. Best bets I can give you are that, number one, we're not going to see a sustained economic recovery here. We're in a very deep and protracted recession that's generally going to be non-responsive to the traditional stimuli. There's a structural problem here tied to households not having adequate income relative to inflation. We're going to have a sharp decline in the value of the dollar. Foreigners, many investors dumping treasuries as that happens. And I can't give you an exact time frame on it. This is more longer term. You will see a hyperinflation. The dollar is going to become worthless. So in that type of a circumstance, if you live in the United States or a dollar-denominated environment, holding something like physical gold and silver, those are hedges against the inflation long-term. Real estate also is a good hedge there, assuming you don't have a shift in government that doesn't allow you to have private ownership of property. Getting some assets outside the U.S. dollar, foreign currencies is a good idea. You don't need to have everything hedged, but if you have some hedging against what can happen here, you're generally going to be ahead of the average person and relatively on top of the world. And anyone who'd like to get into further detail, some of the things I've talked about, we have available on our website a hyperinflation report, which outlines pretty much what's in the works. It was published or was put up in last April. General outlook hasn't changed, except the time frame has moved forward to 2009 to 2014 with a higher risk in this, a particularly high risk in this next year because of what's been happening.
John, one more thing, too. Your website is shadowstats.com.
That's right, shadowstats.com.
Tell listeners how they can subscribe.
There is a link there on the page if you're interested in subscribing. We do have a lot of material available, though, to anyone who wants to look there. We've got our alternative measures of economic activity. We have an archives that gives you everything we've written up through the last 6 months. It's open to the public. Special report on the money supply. And, of course, we're very happy to pick up new subscribers who are looking at the current outlook. But that's all available at shadowstats.com. You just look around the page and you'll see links to the different.
Oh, and again, they can Google it simply by Googling Shadow Stats.
Or just type Shadow Stats in your shadowstats.com in the address bar. That'll take you there.
Oh, indeed, John. That music means we're out of time, and it was another important program. As the situation moves ahead. In the upcoming months, John, I hope you'll come back and you can update listeners again on what's happening.
Sure. Be happy to.
John, my great thanks to you. And we will be back tomorrow. Another distinguished guest, another important topic, live programming all through the week. Please join us then.